Mayor Michael Coleman urges the Democratic Party to choose Columbus or risk losing Ohio in the 2016 presidential election. Democratic National Committee officials are expected to visit Columbus in August. And Columbus has plans for a $125 million renovation and expansion project at the Greater Columbus Convention Center. What a coincidence. Joining us today to talk about all of this on All Sides with Ann Fisher is Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News.
Always a pleasure to be here.
Good to have you here. And a lot of familiar faces, I should say, people that I know. And Julie Carr Smythe of the Associated Press.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. And Andy Chow of Ohio Public Radio's Statehouse News Bureau. And in case you're wondering, Ann Fisher's voice didn't get suddenly lower. I'm Stu Nicholson, and I'll be substituting for Ann over the next couple of weeks. But I love getting started talking politics and other things during the beginning of the week. So let's kind of get started here. As we talked about at the top of the show, the Franklin County Convention Facilities Authority received permission from the county commissioners to borrow money needed for the renovations. How is this going to be paid for? Does the city really have to dole out any money? It sounds like this is all basically going to happen.
Well, it's worth the investment, I guess, in the standpoint of if you land, you know, this sort of thing because of the millions that come into a city. But I'm not quite sure myself how the payments are going to work out.
And even if they don't get the convention, I mean, this has been something that they've been wanting to do for a while, to really develop Columbus as a convention town and really challenge places like Indianapolis, which really has a good grasp on the market right now. So
It definitely needs it. I mean, if you look at the outside of that building, it looks just so 80s with the color scheme and everything.
It's very stark. I wish they had held on to Columbus Union Station instead. So.
It is very dated looking right now.
Kind of moving into the whole issue.
World architect, Laura, though.
Okay, architecturally, I think it's nice. I just don't like the color scheme. Just needs a paint job. Maybe not $125 million worth of work.
You know, it's funny. You've all been around this community for a while. You know, Andy, you're a little bit newer, but still, you know, you've lived in this community. Yeah. And I can recall conversations, you know, among leaders. Oh, we don't have enough convention space. We don't have enough hotel space. You know, we don't have this. We don't have that. And that seems to have been turning around the last couple of years, but is it enough? I mean, from your own observations,
I can also remember many fights about building the convention center at all in the first place, and I think voters turned it back a few times over the decades.
The New World Center, I remember that one.
Yeah, I remember, and remember when the Ohio Center was the new convention center, which is now dwarfed by the current convention center, but. Yes, any city that's going to get a convention of that sort of magnitude is going to have to step up. And oddly enough, somebody said to me they thought Columbus wasn't clean enough to land a convention, that it isn't kept up as well as some of the cities they've seen that have had these. But I imagine they visited those cities on some of their during the conventions when they were trying to be spiffy for the event.
Oh, they've definitely taken care of the hotel part of it. I mean, there's a new hotel going up in the Short North. There's one that just opened up a year or two ago in the Short North area. So I think they've definitely taken care of hospitality-wise. There's all sorts of new hotels going up. But I think the big problem has to be transportation. I just can't imagine transportation being good enough for a really, really large convention like the Democratic National Convention.
That was actually going to be a question that I had coming up. Is that, I mean, does one of the things that was mentioned when Cleveland was awarded the Republican National Convention was their public transportation system, as well as highways, you know, access to aviation, things like that. But public transportation in particular was cited as a major reason that the RNC chose Cleveland. So, I mean, just in that regard, does Columbus have the chops, so to speak, to be able to pull that in, if that's also a major consideration for the Democrats?
You know, I think that most of the conventioneers are going to be on buses with their delegations. That's sort of how they operate. I've been to three of the RNC conventions, New York, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and then also Tampa. And I have to say that I thought the best logistics were in Manhattan, because you could hop on the subway, go, you know, walk a lot of places and use the city buses if you didn't want to be trapped on these delegation buses that they had, because those did get really tied up in traffic. And also when they have these conventions, you know, the security levels really are bounced up quite a bit, and so it just makes the traffic snarls even more hairy. I didn't think that the transportation was that great in Minneapolis-St. Paul, because they had the convention in St. Paul and a lot of the delegations were staying in downtown Minneapolis, and so that was sort of problematic. And I thought the logistics in Tampa were absolutely awful. I mean, I think because the security level had been ratcheted up even further, you know, they were staying in these hotels that weren't that far out distance-wise. It'd be like staying in Worthington, maybe 8 or 9 miles from the convention center, but it would take, you know, an hour and a half to get there. It was ridiculous.
And for we are centrally located in Ohio, but there aren't any rail lines really here anymore. So, you know, you're going to have to drive your car unless you fly. And a lot of people probably would be tempted to drive or come, you know, not by plane because it is drivable. But that brings a lot of traffic into downtown, where it's not easy to get around without a car later.
And then imagine the parking situation. So when you actually get to where you want to go, where are you going to park?
Yeah. I mean, I almost imagine there having to be some dedicated type of parking space and, mm-hmm. you know, shuttles in between, because with the existing parking, it's tough downtown. You know, from, you know, both of us used to work for the State House or News Bureau, and you still do, of course, but you know how tight it gets, you know, in the garage underneath the State Capitol. So, you know, I almost envision there having to be some sort of a remote parking lot that people can go to.
Just build a new one, yeah.
They could solve some of the problems by having shuttle parking, you know, like you park your car at the OSU Stadium for the 4-day window or whatever, and you get a free courtesy ride downtown. And then once you're downtown, I think, you know, if you're staying in a downtown hotel and the convention's right there and you're right near a Nationwide Arena, and you can do a lot of walking to restaurants in Short North and in the Brewery District and downtown. I don't think that the logistics would be too bad once you get rid of your car.
Yeah, I was going to say that too. I'm not sure about the other cities that you were talking about, but Ohio is definitely probably more compact. So walkability wise, it's a little better. And that's, again, going back to Indianapolis. That's what Indianapolis has going for them. If you just get your car there, you can walk everywhere.
Yeah, I know some of the other cities being mentioned are Birmingham, Alabama, New York, Philadelphia, and Phoenix. Now, I know the last three all have fairly good public transportation systems that include rail as a factor, and of course Cleveland has that as well. Do you get the idea that this maybe puts a little bit of pressure on organizations like COTA and some of the ride sharing services that are coming in, and even to some extent the new bike sharing service COGO?
Yeah, I think that, like I said, they'll have to set up some sort of easy shuttle from a remote parking area. They'll have to step up kind of that Columbus circulator or connector. What do they call it?
C-bus circulator.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And have greater frequency on that. Mm-hmm.
I will say I was president of a national journalist organization that had a convention here a few years back. And once they did get here, everybody was absolutely delighted to be downtown and to take part in everything that's around the convention center. I think people were very surprised, and always are with Columbus, because there's so much more here than people realize who aren't familiar with the city. And so once they were here, it was a wonderful place for a convention.
Yeah, having lived here for going on 28 years, it is a decidedly different and better city than it was. You know, I mean, even 5 years ago, I've talked to people that have come back and said, gee, I didn't realize, you know, look at all the work that's happening down on the riverfront and this building, that building, the new hotel, blah, 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 you know, but it's definitely got some, a different city than it once was. Let's talk about the politics a little bit of the DNC coming to town, and just in general. I mean, how much impact do you think politically this has on Ohio. I mean, Mayor Coleman is saying this is a huge mistake if the Democrats don't choose Columbus. You know, they're practically ceding Ohio to the Republican Party if they don't hold their convention here. I mean, admittedly, that's a little self-serving because, you know, he is the mayor of the city. But what's the reality of it? Is, I mean, do you think this actually does have any impact?
Well, I didn't come armed with the statistics, but I think that the convention city has not, what's that statistic, has not actually voted for that president's party.
But not the convention state even.
Yeah. Yeah.
So like Florida went for Obama, even though Tampa had hosted the last one. I think North Carolina went for Romney, even though the Democrats were there in Charlotte. So
yeah,
it doesn't hold true. I think that the mayor, it's a lot of, a lot of bluster. I think he's trying to say what he can to try to bring them in. It would be a big win, obviously.
So if we have both conventions here at Ohio, does that theoretically mean that that
once
Ohio
again
will not vote for either presidential candidate?
We'll go straight party down the middle, even more than
we may have hopes for an independent candidacy here.
Yeah. Well, statistically speaking, looking back at all the conventions that have happened for the Republican and Democratic Party since the 1800s, no state has ever had both conventions the same year, other than if it was at the same city as well. So Chicago has, on the same year, hosted the Republican and Democratic convention, Philadelphia and Houston. But it's never been in the same state in two different cities on the same year. So, I mean, it'd be history-making if it did happen, if they did come to Columbus.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm just really curious about what the actual political impact of it is. And I guess let me put it in this context. Do you think this is going to have any effect? I mean, we're approaching the midterm elections. They're actually 100 days away as of today. Do you think that the fact that one major party has selected a city in Ohio, another major party is at least considering Columbus as a site, does that have any impact on these midterm elections just within Ohio? Does that necessarily translate to more attention, more funding coming in behind candidates? What do you think?
Well, in the case of the governor's race, I think yes, in the sense that the Democratic candidate for governor is the Cuyahoga County executive. And so the landing of that convention has actually gotten him a lot of good press. A lot of positive things have been said about his role in helping the mayor of Cleveland get that event. And so in some ways, maybe it's neutralizing it as a positive for Kasich that his party picked that city. So there's been a little bit of interesting dynamic there in terms of our governor's race.
I think that's a good word to use, just neutralizing it, because I'm not really sure if it's really swung one way or the other, because it's kind of considered a win for both people, for both parties.
Mm-hmm. I find it kind of interesting that the RNC chooses a convention site in what is traditionally a very heavily Democratic part of the state.
But again, if the Democrats were to come here to Columbus, it would be the same thing. I mean, couldn't the governor, who's Republican, claim a great victory for his state and the city where the state house is, even as the Democratic mayor also gets some brownie points? So, you know, I think that I don't know. I don't know that it makes a whole lot of difference in terms of somebody out in rural Ohio saying how they're going to vote for president.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Laura, what do you think?
I think that it does boost up people's attention level a little bit to politics right now. Maybe it'll help them tune in a little bit to the governor's race and the down ticket races. Mm-hmm. I think Julie's right. If Columbus lands it, Kasich can, you know, he's from Westerville, he can claim a little bit of brownie points on that. And then Fitzgerald, of course, is getting his brownie points up there.
Okay. Well, we're getting close to a break time, so let me remind our listeners that you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU NPR 89.7. And you can call us in at 614-292-8513, or you can email a question to us at allsides@wosu.org. We've also have Twitter at I guess it's hashtag WOSU All Sides. Is that correct? So at WOSU All Sites. So at any rate, we'll go ahead. We're getting close to a break, and we will be back with a little bit more political talk and other issues around the state of Ohio. And good morning. Once again, I'm Stu Nicholson. I'm pinch hitting for Ann Fisher on All Sides. And we, again, have our political roundtable, our reporter roundtable, I should say, but although we are discussing a lot of politics this morning. And joining us again this morning is Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News, Andy Chow of Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, and Julie Carr Smythe of the Associated Press. One of the things that's really been in the news a lot lately has been this allegation being leveled at Attorney General Mike DeWine, accusing him of passing over competent collection vendors in favor of a friend's new collection agency, picking collectors based on their campaign donations, and using his position to benefit his private charity fund. Laura, let me start with you. I mean, you've been on this story quite a bit as well, and just kind of maybe what's the Cliff Notes version of what Mr. Pepper, the opposition candidate, is throwing at Mike DeWine?
Well, the Dayton Daily News published a story a little bit over a week ago that examined how the debt collectors are selected by the Attorney General's office. Debt collectors are paid a percentage of what they collect. They are usually agencies, collection agencies, and then attorneys who go after unpaid taxes, medical bills, defaulted student loans, that sort of thing. There's like $5 billion in debt that's hanging out there that needs to be collected every year. And Mike DeWine's office passed over more experienced national firms with licensing in all the appropriate states and hired a new company called Selco that's owned and operated by Pete Spitaleri. Spitaleri is a big contributor to the Ohio Republican Party and the Summit County Republican Party. Both of those political parties support DeWine's campaigns pretty extensively. And so that was one finding. And Spitaleri's firm didn't have the experience and didn't have the licensing. As a matter of fact, they had to turn back some of the assignments because they weren't licensed. And then also there's an interesting pattern of when the contributions come in. I looked at before, during, and after, or just after the window in which the AG's office was asking for qualifications from these agencies and attorneys, and they had like $215,000 just in this last window, which was last spring. $215,000 poured into the Republican Party and also to Mike DeWine's campaign. And thirdly, DeWine, according to his calendar, you know, he met with politically connected people like David Myhall, his former fundraiser, Alex Arshnikov, who's a lobbyist and Summit County, longtime Summit County GOP chairman, and Spitaleri and others. I think he took a really very much a hands-on approach to selecting these debt collectors. And they did away with the scoring system that had been in place under the Cordray administration as well.
So there's a triangle there that goes on of, you know, the Attorney General meeting with people who are then getting work and have given or then give in sort of a close proximity to the doling out of the contracts, which is, you know, it's concerning. It's concerning. Some of the judging, some scoring forms that I think Laura found and reported on had been changed. The scores on those had been crossed out or, altered. And so it looked as if, and that would bump certain firms or key firms into the scoring bracket. What they've told us is that, those were people's personal notes, and as people are judging firms, they're going to naturally change those. But we don't know, you know, the exact second or moment within that process that happened. But so that's really the story. The other piece of this is this charity down in Haiti that runs the Becky DeWine School, and is that's named for Mike DeWine's daughter who died in a car crash. And some of these same donors are showing up down there as giving to the charity. It's difficult with the way business filings are to know exactly when those donations came in, but they're certainly within the calendar year that some of these folks showed up for the first time getting state business.
Now, Mike DeWine says that he's not arm twisting. He's not telling people give to the Becky DeWines, go give to Hands Together. That organization does, as far as we tell, fantastic work. I mean, they provide meals and education to desperately poor kids. Mm. I think probably these firms, they hear Mike DeWine's involved in the school and they think, oh, this is another opportunity to score some brownie points. Mm-hmm. But there were, I think, maybe six or so, a kind of a combination of collections attorneys and lobbyists and
law firms,
including those that also do securities fraud work.
Just let me ask you, I mean, do you think this, from your observation, do you think this has any legs at all as far as politically, and I say that in terms of, is this something that will resonate with voters in an election, or is this a little bit too in the weeds for them?
I think it's a fairly complex idea. I think that people probably get the general gist of it, and that does not help Mike DeWine. But Mike DeWine also is, from what I understand, you know, the polls are really in his favor. And he has, for the last 3.5 years, gotten a lot of really good press. He is extremely accessible with the media. He holds press conferences all the time. The Attorney General's office is involved in lots and lots of issues, so he is out front on lots and lots of issues. Probably a very close second to the governor, I would say.
I was about to say, he's got a pretty high visibility.
Well, actually, I think his name ID is higher in Ohio than John Kasich. He's been our U.S. senator. He's been the lieutenant governor of the state. He's been a state rep. He's been around really for many decades. And, you know, as Laura says, he gets a lot of good press for the sort of the official business of the office and is accessible. He gets on a lot of local television and that kind of thing and has a good reputation around the state for among voters, I think.
And he's willing to talk to reporters. I mean, if you call his office and say, hey, is the Attorney General available, they'll like 9 times out of 10 get him on the phone for you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can recall that back, you know, when I was still working as a reporter on local TV and at the State House News Bureau, he wasn't hard to get a hold of at all. Mm-hmm. Even if his staff said he'll call you right back, he called you right back.
Mm-hmm. As far as the campaign's concerned, I think that, as you're saying, how much weight would this have? I think Pepper would have to find a way to take it one step further, because right now DeWine can say, listen, we're not doing anything wrong. Basically, you can't really prove that there's a direct connection of him saying, listen, we're only going to hire these people because of the contributions. So I think he would have to take it one step further to really prove that.
You know, pay-to-play schemes are always talked about but rarely proven. Mm-hmm. If you look at what happened in federal court with Ben Suarez up in Canton, it's a prime example of where Josh Mandel's campaign for U.S. Senate was involved in getting Suarez to raise money. Mm-hmm. And then was also involved in getting the treasurer to write a letter on official state letterhead, to intervene on Suarez's behalf on his business interests out in California. But Suarez was not convicted of any of those charges. He was convicted of obstruction of justice for stuff that happened kind of downstream as the investigation got underway.
Mm-hmm. We've got a caller on the line, John from Marysville, I guess, asking about an update on the anti-abortion bill passed by the General Assembly. John, what's your question specifically?
Well, my question pertains to, I think it was last spring, 2013, anti-abortion legislation was passed. I think it involved rape crisis clinics as well as not being able to disclose reproductive health options to women. And I was just wondering, overall, has there been any movement toward closing abortion clinics, or are there some pending to be closed because of that rather, I think, dramatic legislation on behalf of the General Assembly and the governor?
I think that a couple have closed. Some are remaining open that I know of. And it kind of depended on whether or not they were getting some public funding, which I think was the way that bill was worded. And we have seen quite a few close. I don't have the exact numbers in front of me. One bill that did not pass is that bill we called the heartbeat bill that had to do with you couldn't perform an abortion once you could hear a fetal heartbeat, which can be about 6 weeks into a pregnancy. And that bill really has stalled despite the virulent efforts of the lobbyist who's running that campaign, trying to run attack ads against the senators who won't move it, and flying planes over the state house and all sorts of other things. So we don't quite have the all-out ban that we had that they were trying for.
And there are other legal cases going on right now in the court system where clinics are trying to stay open, and they're arguing that they should be staying open. So those are also pending.
Yeah, it almost seems as if there's still as conservative as the General Assembly appears to be, there still seems to be a little bit of reticence there among the members of the General Assembly to go take it that step further. Is that accurate?
I would venture to guess that has something to do with Governor Kasich. I think that he might be either hinting or directly discussing with them that he doesn't want that to land on his desk, especially in an election year. That's a tough one for him. He is a pro-life candidate, but that bill is viewed as pretty extreme. It would be one of the most extreme in the country.
And we've heard a lot of talk, both nationally and statewide, about the quote unquote war on women. And you know, there's a lot of political heat being generated along those lines.
Well, even Right to Life has not supported that that bill, in large part because they're concerned that it would lead to a giant court challenge that they'd end up losing down the road.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's the concerns of many of the legislators, too. That's why they don't want to move on it.
In a somewhat related story, we have a bill that was introduced by State Representative Kathleen Clyde, Democrat from Kent, that would require Ohio companies to cover birth control, kind of an answer to the Hobby Lobby decision from the Supreme Court. Maybe I'm showing great insight into the obvious by saying that, you know, it doesn't seem like that would stand a chance in the General Assembly politically. But what are your thoughts on on that?
Well, I think you're right. I don't think it's going anywhere. But I think it's designed to kind of gin up the base for the Democrats. They have been making a lot of noise about the war on women, and they've been trying to kind of draw a stark contrast with the Republicans and get women, you know, kind of fired up and out to vote for the Democrats. And it just might work. I think that that the abortion issue is one that where people don't really change their minds too much. They're set one way or another. But I think people, let's face it, almost everybody uses contraceptives. And they consider it a private matter. And I think that if government is involved in telling them what can be covered and what can't be covered, et cetera, it starts to kind of hit close to home to a lot of people.
Julie?
I think that, we're starting to see themes within the race for statewide office in the state. And the Democrats rolled out on the women's platform. They like to show off their slate, which has more women than the Republicans. The only woman on the Republican side is Lieutenant Governor Mary Taylor on this year's slate. And so, again, I think that the governor and a lot of the senators who are up for election as well and representatives would prefer not to have to chime in on that kind of an issue right now. And the Democrats, as the minority party within the both chambers of the legislature, are trying to keep their themes alive. They're doing this also on the voting rights theme, and they're trying to sort of work on a culture of corruption theme with some Republicans citing some of these DeWine things, the thing with Mandel that we just talked about, and they're working on that theme. And so we're seeing a lot of this land in our email boxes, and not much of it really makes the newspapers because it's their bills that aren't really going anywhere.
They also have the anti-worker theme, the kind of pulling, hearkening back to Senate Bill 5 and trying to make sure that the union membership and their allies remember that as well.
Well, let me take a little break here and remind people you can call in and phone in your questions here or email us your questions. Phone number here at All Sides is 614-292-8513, or you can email your question to allsides@wosu.org or Twitter us at WOSU All Sides. And
I do stand corrected on the female issue by a text message here that there are two female Supreme Court justices, including the chief. So
true. You know, at one point, and we're bumping up towards a break here. We've got maybe about a minute before a break here. At what point do you start to see this kind of, you know, the things that we were just talking about, you know, the concern over unions, war on women? At what point do you see this really starting to, you know, to bubble up among the electorate? What are some of the signs that you think we should be looking for that, hey, this is going to become a lot hotter?
Well, the grassroots union movement, I know, is getting started. I think they're going to be knocking on doors. They're going to be trying to get this working class message door to door into people's minds. And I've heard from some outside groups that are starting to get ramped up here, a little bit of a revisiting of the Senate Bill 5 argument. That's really their only best chance of getting people out to the polls and voting for Democrats.
You know, part of the problem is that they do have multiple themes. I mean, they're talking about women, abortion, contraceptives, voting rights, culture of corruption, workers, fairness on taxes. And I think the Kasich team has been focused mostly, their messages were all about jobs and the economy, which is a lot cleaner and much more direct. And I think the Democrats are trying to appeal to all kinds of different platforms, all kinds of little tentacles out there.
And it's a good theme. We just started a series, actually. AP's doing an Ohio's Economy series for this year that just kicked off this weekend. And, you know, it's a theme that works. If you're a governor that comes in after a recession, naturally, the numbers are going to go up. And then if you're a governor that also has put programs in that have shown some results, then stick on that theme, and usually it's a winning strategy.
And hold that thought. Let's talk about that when we come back from a break. Right now, we're going to take a little break. Once again, this is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News and online at WOSU.org. Welcome back for the last third of All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Stu Nicholson, and once again, I am joined by Julie Carr Smythe of the Associated Press.
Hello.
Andy Chow of Ohio Public Radio's Statehouse News Bureau.
Hi.
Myself, a former alumni of that august organization, and Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News. Julie, let's talk a little bit about jobs and the economic recovery. You just through the AP published a story talking about how Ohio has added 244,000 jobs during the Kasich administration, but yet we're still seeing a slow recovery. Tell us a little bit more about that. And what
right. So when you look at these figures, the raw number of jobs, these would be non-agricultural total employment jobs, that we are up close to, you know, half a million people during the recession that preceded that. You know, we can argue about when it began to recover, but Ohio lost about 430,000 jobs. So certainly, 200,000+ jobs gained is a positive for Ohio's economy and good news for many Ohioans who are back at work. But there are about a third of states that have fully recovered from the recession. The nation as a whole has fully recovered the raw number of jobs from the recession. So Ohio is lagging in that regard. Both are true. You know, my view is people just need to know both when they go into the into the campaign season and decide how that fits into what they think about the candidates. But both are true statements, and Ohio does traditionally lag when we recover from recessions and downturns in the economy. It takes us a little longer, and there are some concrete things that aren't going to change about our economy, which is that it was built on the manufacturing sector that is now almost gone. The one company that's been fighting to stay alive over in the far eastern part of the state is Ormet, and that's been a huge deal because of the fact that that's an odd hybrid of about half the people from who work there are from Ohio and half are from West Virginia, but all the unemployment has to be paid by Ohio people, and so it affects Ohio a lot, and the unions are really trying to hammer the governor on that.
What kind of jobs are these that we're seeing in this gain? I mean, are we talking really good, solid career type jobs, or are we talking retail service, minimum wage, or is it a mix?
I would say it's a mix. The private sector is leading the charge. They're private sector jobs, and a lot of the better jobs are in high tech areas, which has been one of Kasich's focuses. And so, but they're new age sort of jobs. In terms of real career jobs, we have a lot of health care in this state, a lot of research and development sort of work. But our overall wage, average wage in the state has fallen generally over the last decade because a lot of the jobs that people are returning to don't have the salaries that they had in the past.
I know in over the weekend I had a chance to listen to a speech delivered to the Cleveland City Club by Amy Hanauer, the executive director of Policy Matters Ohio, and she made that point that that we've got our minimum wage hasn't changed in Ohio since 2009, and she also made the point that we've lost a lot of public sector jobs, some of that at the state level, some of it at the local level because of right. budget cuts. So are these two factors kind of running counter? I mean, we've got private sector jobs starting to ramp up, but yet, it almost seems like, what's happened on the public sector side is somewhat canceling that out.
Yeah, the biggest hit to the economy has been the 25,000 or so lost jobs at the local level. We've also lost federal government jobs. We're in an era where the Republican Party and with some prodding from the Tea Party, wants to shrink government. So, it's a reality for a leader like John Kasich that he, is going to want to look as if he's making efficiencies in government, shrinking the taxpayer bill of government at the same time that he wants to grow the economy. I will say the state government under John Kasich has grown. There are more state government jobs in Ohio today than there were. So some of our recovery is being affected by that.
What about at the local level? Laura, Joel, Andy, I'm sorry, I almost called you by your dad's name. I'm sorry. Anyways, what are your thoughts? What are your observations on this?
Well, I think that first off, the Amy Hanauer is saying that the minimum wage has not increased, but actually the minimum wage is now indexed to inflation. So every January 1st or so, it has been going up a little bit. That was based on a voter-initiated statute in, what, 2004?
I think she's saying I think she's saying they haven't raised the percentage at which it should be increased. Yeah. I think that I've heard her say that before.
Specifically, you know, she's saying minimum wage hasn't changed in relation to productivity since 2009. A lot of the benefit from the increase in productivity in Ohio is, you know, going towards the proverbial one percenters, and it's not really showing up at the lower level. So, on the public sector jobs at the local and regional level, a lot of governments, and again, hearkening back to something that Amy Hanauer mentioned in her speech, they did a poll of local governmental units, and 70% of them have had to make some sorts of cuts, either in programs or layoffs and things like this. As good a news as 244 new jobs is, does what's happening on the public sector side, because it's not only the people that have lost their jobs in the public sector at the local level, but it's the services that aren't getting done, that aren't happening, or are happening slower because there aren't as many people doing the jobs before. Does that potentially have a backlash effect in this upcoming election?
Well, all the communities have been trying to make cuts to make do for the local government funding cuts, and so I think they've tried to do their best to make those cuts without cutting anything that's very important, the emergency services and everything like that. So,
I think that there have been a lot of cuts in school districts and city halls and fire halls and police stations across the state at the local level. And I think that I know that a lot of local officials really start grinding their teeth when they hear from John Kasich that he closed a big budget gap without raising taxes, et cetera, because they're like, yeah, but the footnote on that is that you cut funding to local governments. And yes, the funding went back up in the second Kasich budget, but it still doesn't match what the amount that he cut in the first Kasich budget. So there's some animosity, I think, from local government officials that Kasich is going around bragging, saying he has worked budget miracles, when they're like, well, the only miracle is that you guys kicked the can down the street to us.
And once again, that's another campaign rhetoric that we're hearing from Ed Fitzgerald, the Democratic nominee for governor, that he's trying to, just like they're trying to go back to the workers' rights issues, they're also trying to go back to the cuts in local funding issue.
And he, coming from Cuyahoga County as a local official, you know, he's speaking from some level of experience.
Another interesting thing about this, because I find Ohio's budget very interesting on so many levels, but another interesting thing about it is that, you know, we are centralizing our government services a lot more, and doesn't always compare one to one when you cut a local dollar as it used to, because, you know, if you build efficiencies in or achieve some efficiencies, then some of those costs are reduced. But definitely the local government fund, which is a discretionary fund for police, fire, and so forth, and school district funding. The other thing they did in the state budget was they made some changes to the way schools can put up their own levies, and so that the school districts would tell you they're definitely hurting.
One of the things that I've heard people talk about, especially in the environmental community, is the passage of legislation to freeze the state energy standards. There have been some who have said, basically, why don't you just hang a sign up at the entrances to Ohio, telling the energy industry, or at least the alternative energy industry, you might as well not try and do work here in Ohio, because it's not going to be a good environment, whether it's the wind energy industry or solar power and like that. What are you thinking is, and you've covered some energy topics for the State House News Bureau, what do you think is going to happen out of that?
Well, you're definitely right. That is what we're hearing from the advanced energy industry. They're saying that Ohio is no longer a state that is dependable. So even though right now the bill that passes a freeze, it's a 2-year freeze, so a commission can look at the standards and see if it's actually raising somebody's electric bills. But the industry says even if they do come back and even if they do reinstate some sort of standard, that industries don't want to come to Ohio when they don't know any given year if those standards are going to be cut again or frozen or rolled back or anything like that. And so...
Right. The new dynamic, though, is just very shortly after this bill became law, came the federal clean air standards and the changes that are going to be imposed on the states, whether we like it or not. And so I think that the EPA and you know, those folks here in the state are going to have to work something out. The compromise, if you remember, on this bill was that if the legislature doesn't act, the Ohio's threshold for the use of renewable energy will return in 2 years. So it could be, now that that standard is there, that they just sit and do nothing and it goes back to the way it was, rather than wade in. And, you know, I think that was an option that the governor made sure was in the bill, so that the default wasn't that it went away forever, but that it stayed.
We got a caller, Rick from Grandview Heights. You're live on All Sides with Ann Fisher. What's your question?
Hi. I think I heard one of the speaker, your great speaker, or your guest, say that state government employment had increased during the Kasich administration. And I almost drove off the road because certainly, if that's true, it's not Republican, something a Republican would brag about or even talk about. So I was wondering if she could expand upon that.
Okay, Julie?
Well, it's if you look at the raw numbers, there is an overall decrease in the number of government employees in Ohio, led by local government and federal government. And I'm sure I'm going to get another text here in a minute if I'm wrong on this, but there has been a slight increase in state employment. Certainly the government sector is nowhere near as large in Ohio as the private sector, and the private sector is, you know, you could say it's booming. There are quite a number of jobs. Obviously, we have the lowest unemployment rate for 2 months running now, that since the recession began, it's around 5%, which is a really good number. So that is what my numbers showed.
I just looked up on the DAS website, the Department of Administrative Services, and it shows that there's 53,275 state employees right now. But in January of 2011, when Kasich took office, it was 58,304.
So it's down.
So it's actually down by about 5,000.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that follows a trend. I think that was a trend. It had been heading in that direction for a while.
Okay. Rick, thanks for your call, and I hope you stopped driving. So
yeah, sorry about that, Rick.
Anyway, but we've got about 2 minutes left here. Let me go back to kind of a political, political football kind of question, I guess. Looking at the governor's race, what do each of the candidates do you think have to do between now and November to kind of win the hearts and minds? What do you see them doing, or what do you think they need to do?
What I'm seeing from at least Governor Kasich is trying to not even talk about the campaign at all and try to just continue with this, I'm the governor, we're doing this with jobs, we've been creating jobs, we've been doing this, and not even acknowledging really his opponent in his campaign. And then on Fitzgerald's side, like we were saying, there's going to be a ramp up in efforts to get the message out there on some anti-worker things and war on women rhetoric.
We've got about a minute left. Julie, what do you think?
I think John Kasich keeps on doing what he's doing. He's very popular at the moment. Ed Fitzgerald needs to find something that sticks with voters better than what's stuck so far.
Yeah, it doesn't appear that he's really found that quite yet. So.
I agree with both of my dad, though, also that Fitzgerald's got to start raising some serious money so he can get on TV more.
Well, we want to thank you again, Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News, Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, Julie Carr Smythe of the Associated Press. I want to thank you all for being with us for the Reporter Roundtable here on All Sides with Ann Fisher. And we'll be taking a break and coming back in the next hour talking about the OSU marching band story. So stay tuned for that. Thank you.